Many things make our region unique. There are things you can see here that you just don't see anywhere else, like Crater Lake or Castle Crags, for example. Then there's the vegetation. Our region is home to the lovely shrub known as manzanita, you know, the silver dollar leaves and the dark, smooth bark. We can stop thinking of manzanita as a single thing. There are many different species of manzanita, and we get to learn about all but one in the new Field Guide to Manzanitas, California, North America, and Mexico by Michael Kaufman, Tom Parker, and Michael Vasey. Michael Kaufman is an educator, nature lover, publisher, and writer. He's visited the exchange before talking about earlier books on conifers. This is his first visit to talk about a plant without needles. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
You bet. Tom Parker's here as well. He's a biology professor at San Francisco State and a lover of manzanitas. He has 9 manzanita species growing in his front yard. Tom, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So how many are there altogether?
Tom, you want to take that?
Well, yeah, that's for Tom.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, they're about 105 and counting.
And you leave one out of the book, I understand. What's that about?
Well, that one is in Guatemala.
Okay.
It only grows in the top of volcanoes there.
That is interesting. That tells us something, I think, about the manzanitas and their adaptability to certain environments. I mean, they are hardy plants, and what kinds of environments are they best suited for?
They're best suited for really crappy environments. Things that are really dry, really wet, very nutrient poor.
And Tom, tell us about your own fascination with manzanitas.
I've been interested in these plants for over 30 years because they have adapted to so many places. But also because they have 2 different life histories with respect to wildfire. Some of the plants resprout like you expect plants to do after they burn, but a lot of the plants, most of them, are killed by fire, and they regenerate only from seed that's stored in the soil. That I found really fascinating, and it leads to a lot of ecological questions and evolutionary questions.
So the actual parent plants do die in the fire, but the seeds below are the ones that that keep the manzanita coming back.
That's right. And because all the parents are dead, there's no history at that site except for all the seedlings coming up, and they get to respond to the new environment.
Interesting. We'll get into the ramifications of that in a bit. I want to come to Michael Kaufman now and ask you, given your love for conifers, how'd you end up on a manzanita book?
That's a great question. Well, there's a couple of reasons there. The first is that in my last book, Conifers of the Pacific Slope, I borrowed some photographs from a guy named Jeff Bisbee, who is the photographer for our current book, Field Guide to Manzanitas. And Jeff became fascinated with the genus and took Tom's advice, went out, photographed every species, and came to me and said, "Hey, I've got all these great photographs." So that gave me the idea, because I've always been fascinated with manzanitas, but kind of like you said in your intro, I just wasn't quite sure one species from the next, because I would see one in Southern California and one in Northern California, and I knew they were slightly different, but I didn't quite know why. And so this book was really a way for me to learn the genus as well and to begin to understand the diversity that Tom mentioned across the California floristic province. It's funny, when you were given the weather forecast there, I thought you were going to say this is the perfect forecast for manzanitas between the lightning strikes and the fire and the warm temperatures. So they really are emblematic of the California floristic province, which extends from northern Baja California to around just north of Grants Pass in southwest Oregon. So I just found them to be highly interesting. I also taught outdoor education for about 10 years, and they were that plant that you could always go to and teach kids about adaptations, plant adaptations, because there's so many different aspects of the plant that have evolved to fit our climate, whether it's the directionality of their leaves to maybe reduce solar radiation in hot environments, or that smooth bark that you mentioned, which potentially channels water to the roots when it does rain within our sometimes dry climate. So,
Michael,
fascinating group of plants.
Absolutely. Who's the book for, Michael, and how do you hope people will use it?
Well, like I said, in a lot of ways it's for me. I wrote this thing because I wanted to learn these plants, and I worked with Tom and Michael as well. Tom and Michael are really the experts on manzanitas in California.
That's Michael Vasey, who is not on the call today.
Right, Michael Vasey. But, you know, again, it's a way to explore our local environment and get to know how plants are adapted to fit within it. So what we've done is we've treated these 105 taxa, which is about, so there's about 70 species, 105 taxa, which includes subspecies of those taxa. And nine of those species are in Southwest Oregon, Southern Oregon, so in Northern California as well. So there's a couple of endemic species that live in Josephine County, over by Cave Junction, south into Del Norte County. So that means these are species that only live in that region, on the Josephine ophiolite, on that serpentine there. So it's, again, it's a way that that we can understand how endemism occurs, how these species evolve. And then the other thing is, whenever I would go out on my conifer forays, I would always find manzanitas. And they're actually ecologically quite similar. Like Tom was saying, they love poor soils, and they don't really like competition from other species, so that they find these environments that are suboptimal, as we call them in the book. They're just not perfect places for a lot of plants, and manzanitas and conifers like those spots.
So, Tom, to paraphrase you a bit, they tend to seek out the crappy environments.
Well, they're certainly adapted to a diverse array of those types of places. They have a lot of mutualisms that help them out. They have fungi that associate with their roots, and they develop fungal roots that are called mycorrhizae, which most people might know about. And that mutualism enables them to get the few nutrients that are available in those places.
So if the fungi aren't there, do the manzanita just not thrive or just not grow?
They don't do well at the beginning, but the spores come in from every place, and they share a lot of fungi that also produce mycorrhizae on conifers, so they're available.
Okay, a lot to learn yet about manzanitas. Field Guide to Manzanitas, California, North America, and Mexico is in front of us. Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker with Michael Vasey are the authors. Michael Kaufman and Parker, Tom Parker, join us on The Exchange. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. We'll provide phone number and email address after a break. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about one of the region's most famous shrubs, the manzanita, or the manzanitas, plural, 105 taxa, it turns out, of which a bunch live in our region. Okay, there's one that's not covered in this field guide to manzanitas that our guests are talking about. Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker are among the writers with Michael Vasey, and they are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join us as we talk about manzanitas and the other members of their family at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Tom Parker, I want to call manzanita deciduous because of the big flat leaves, but I'm wrong, aren't I?
You are. They're completely evergreen. They keep their leaves for more than 12 months, so each year's growth of leaves overlaps with the previous.
So there's no particular cycle there, or is there?
Well, there's a cycle because they live in pretty dry environments, so the leaves kind of deteriorate through time. They lose the ability to photosynthesize at fast rates because they have less and less water available to them, so they tend to drop them after a while. You'll notice in some years they only seem to have new leaves. Those are usually really dry years.
Mm-hmm.
And in other years, they can keep older leaves for a couple more years.
While we're talking about the leaves, Michael, you mentioned in the book that there's, in fact, you mentioned earlier just a bit about the orientation of the leaves, which is an indication of how efficient this plant can be. What's that about?
Sure. Well, in order to live within our Mediterranean-type climate here in the California Floristic Province, we obviously have this summer dry season. Now, recently, at least in the northern part of that, there has been some rain in the summer, but usually we don't expect regular rain and for, 4 to 6 months. So a manzanita has to be pretty keen at conserving water, and one way to do that is to orient leaves instead of, say, directly facing the sun. They can align them vertically so that they're perpendicular to the ground, so to speak, and they don't ever receive direct solar radiation, and that helps with the conservation of water within the plant.
But then do they run the risk of drowning if they do get rained on in that period?
Well, you mean the plant itself?
Yes.
No, because these they're typically shrubs, and Tom and I went on a great hike recently, and was sharing some more information. He said they'll even get to be tree size if they have the right conditions. So there's very few that are just prostrate along the ground. There are some in our region that grow in the higher mountains that creep along the ground, but mostly they're growing up off the ground.
Okay, which turns to a great question for Tom that I think a lot of people still want to know. And believe me, after 30 years of living here, I still run across people who have trouble telling the difference. Manzanita and Madrone. Turns out they are part of the same subfamily, but what are the differences, Tom Parker?
The main differences are the flowers that you can see, but that's kind of hard to notice. But the Madrone is a large tree that produces berries. Our Madrone produces succulent berries with very tiny seeds, and the Manzanitas produce very different kinds of fruit. They have a dry exterior. They're more like a dry kind of berry. They have the inside that, if it was a berry, we would be eating is a dry, mealy condition, and then they have small nuts, very different from the Madrone.
What about the way in which they grow? I mean, there's a sense that I've gotten from some people that Madrones tend to grow more as trees. Manzanita, they tend to be lower and shrub-like.
Yeah, our Madrone is definitely a tree. It's part of the mixed evergreen forest that runs from Southern California north to British Columbia. So it's a nice forest tree there. The Arctostaphylos, the Manzanitas never get that large. They can be 6 or 7 meters in height, but that would have to be a pretty short forest for them to be a part of.
Okay. Arctostaphylos, then, is the genus we're talking about that all these species of Manzanita dwell within?
That's right.
Okay. Arctostaphylos, if you want to look that one up. Let's take a call here. We have Grumpy John and Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Manzanitas with Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker.
Hi. The Manzanitas on my property have clusters of very small pink apple-looking fruits, hence the name Manzanita, or small apple. And the Madrone, I understand, was named because its bark, when freshly cut, is very soft, so you could carve Madonnas out of them, and that's how they got their name. I want to know if all of the Manzanitas, the little apples, if they all have these pink edible berries.
All right, good question. Thanks for that, Grumpy John.
Thank you.
Tom?
They do. They all have the same looking berries. They differ in size. You can make a nice tea from the outer coat, but the rest of it's pretty tasteless.
Hmm. And the berries are edible? I mean, are there any poisonous things that grow out of Manzanitas?
The leaves are poisonous, but they're kind of tough to eat. They're pretty woody.
All right, but the berries themselves, the fruit that grows on the Manzanitas, is edible?
That's right. You can make a tea out of it. The different species differ in the flavor, so you have to be careful which one you make a tea out of. You might not like it. But I have tried tea for some, and they're pretty tasty.
Okay. Michael, you were about to add something in there?
Yeah, it seems that from what I've read and research I've done, it's Arctostaphylos uber-ursi, which is the most far-reaching and ranging Manzanita species that actually grows around the Northern Hemisphere. Has been very popular medicinally for both Native Americans for that tea and for other uses medicinally as well. So that's probably a safe one to give a try since it's been used so widely.
Michael, you mentioned the California Floristic Province, which is a term I hadn't seen until this book. Can you expand on the concept just a bit and explain what it includes?
Sure. So there's five Mediterranean-type climate regions in the world, and we know them generally for being perfect places to grow wine grapes. So I'm talking about the Mediterranean in Europe, South Africa, Chile, and then also some regions in Southwest Australia. So these five regions have in common this climate where it's generally wet in the winters and drier in the summers. And because of that dichotomy in the climate, it's not hospitable to a lot of plants. So plants have to be adapted to those that dry season. And really that comes into play just about at the California-Oregon border to the south. You know, the Rogue Valley replicates that California floristic province. But as you move further north into northern Oregon and Washington and British Columbia, you'll get a lot more rain in the summer. And because of that pattern, the California current that sort of brings the cooler water from the north, that climate has developed here over about the last 5 million years. And with that evolution of the Mediterranean-type climate, manzanitas have really evolved to fit that climate well. So they're kind of one of the two key representatives within the California floristic province that in many ways defines it as far as botanically. So I think it's pretty interesting. And, you know, the other thing is we're really familiar with this group of plants in a lot of ways because they're in the heath family. So they're, which is one of the 15 most speciose plant families in the world. So within that family, we use many, many of the species, things like rhododendrons for our yards, blueberries. We just went on a blueberry hunt with my family, huckleberries, cranberries. So these are all relatives of the manzanita, but the manzanita is specially adapted really to only within California and a little bit beyond. There's a few exceptions. So in that way, I really find it interesting. And in that way, I feel like this book is written for amateur and expert botanists alike to really understand, A, the place we call home within this California floristic province, and then again that diversity, because I think we've done a really nice job of making this information accessible for people with spectacular pictures, and then Tom and Michael with their great species descriptions. So I think it's exciting in that way, this book.
Michael Kaufman, Tom Parker, and Michael Vasey are the authors of Field Guide to Manzanitas. Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker join us. There are photographs by Jeff Bisbee in there, too. And you can join our discussion about manzanitas, one of the more fascinating bits of flora in our region. 800-838-3760 to join the discussion by phone with your questions and comments, or send them in by email to jx@jeffnet.org. So does that mean, Tom Parker, that other than the one species you cited living on the volcano in Guatemala, that that this is pretty much the only part of the world where we're going to find manzanitas?
Well, they're widespread in western North America. It's just that the majority of them, over, almost 100 of them, are in the California floristic province. But in the Rocky Mountains, there's the greenleaf manzanita and Arctostaphylos uba ursi. They're pretty widespread. And there's some in Mexico that sneak up into Arizona. And Arizona has one taxa that's only found there as well.
And Michael, when you're out looking for manzanita, I mean, how localized are some of the species distributions? Is it along the lines of, like, you know, one side of a valley you'd get one species and the other side of a valley you'd get the other?
Yeah, it can be that spectacular. I actually just took a trip down to southern and central California. I went to San Luis Obispo, and each mountain range is composed of a different type of rock. And within each of those mountain ranges surrounding the valley of San Luis Obispo is a different species of manzanita. And then as I came back north, Tom and I met up on San Bruno Mountain, which is the mountain just by the San Francisco airport. And on that mountain alone, there's two species that grow nowhere else on the planet. So they can be highly localized. And Tom, correct me on this, but it's something around 60% of all manzanitas have extremely restricted range. So it's fascinating in that respect. But then there's the other ones, like we said, the Arctostaphylos uba ursi, which the subspecies grows on that volcano in Guatemala, but it also grows all around the northern hemisphere. You can find them in Virginia. You can find them in Maine. You can find them across Canada. You can find them on the coast right by Gold Beach and in Del Norte County. So they're in the Crescent City area. So there's certain exceptions to that highly endemic or endemism within the genus.
Does that mean, Tom Parker, then, that they are very, very carefully adapted to the very specific environments they're in? I mean, particularly when we talk about the serpentine soils in the Illinois Valley in Oregon, it seems like they've really found a way to find this niche in which they can work it out.
That's true. They seem to have the ability to adapt to very unique combinations of of soil minerals, and a lot of times, like places like serpentine, where it's pretty toxic to a large number of plants, they can adapt and do quite well and begin to dominate those types of areas. There's a lot of examples of that. Michael Kaufman just gave you one for the San Luis Obispo area, but there's examples pretty much everywhere, volcanic soils, granites, you name it.
But generally in fairly non-nutritious soil?
That's right. They even dominate sand dune areas. I was just in Santa Barbara County looking at an undescribed subspecies, and it's only found on Matilaha sandstone that breaks down into really just pure sand. So it's there's nothing in it that's nutritious.
So just again, to go back to what you said originally, they look pretty crappy soils is what they're looking for.
That's
we're,
right.
We're talking about the Field Guide to Manzanitas with two of the authors, Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker. Michael Vasey is also involved with the production of the book. Let's take a call here from Tangren in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I've lived among manzanitas. I have manzanitas all over my property, which is granite near Ashland. And I wanted to tell people that you can kill a manzanita with too much water. I inadvertently did that when my pots were, I had plants on my deck, and the manzanitas got too much water, and they developed long cracks along the limb that looked kind of like, a twisted hose that was trying to straighten out or something like that. Anyway, it killed the tree. And the other thing is, I believe that the leaves kill other plants, and there's hardly anything growing underneath my manzanitas, and I usually fish the leaves out of the pots if they fall into them to keep them from killing my other plants. So I'd be interested in comments on either of those.
Great details for those, Tangren. Thanks
for
that. Appreciate it. And so let's talk about the water part and the acidity of the leaves, which is well documented in the book, Tom Parker.
Yeah, they're adapted to pretty dry conditions. And like a lot of plants in California, if you start watering them, they don't do well at all. The roots begin to rot, and then fungi can invade and become pathogenic. But you're right, the leaves are quite acidic, and they change the acidity of the soil. That actually increases the lack of nutrients in the soil as it gets in more and more acid, which is why they have to rely on fungi to help them pull nutrients out.
So they're actually hurting themselves with their own acidic leaves?
Well, they're kind of helping themselves because they've got those mutualists
that
do the work for them, but they're certainly hurting other species.
All right, that's a pretty amazing the amount of acid. And then the characteristic that Tangren pointed out about the watering, the cracks, is that a fairly typical response to overwatering for a manzanita?
It could be. It sounds to me like that's a fungal invasion that's taking the plant out because they've been overwatered.
All right, let's take another call. We have Charlie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes,
manzanitas and madrones, so interesting and beautiful. They give such a great aesthetic look to the whole forest. A couple of things that I have found over the years that are to be of interest with them. One is that apparently the manzanita and madrone branches make excellent perches for caged birds, for like canaries and finches. Apparently they are the single most ideal, and there's actually a market for those branches. Apparently they impart no dangerous tannins or anything to the little canaries. That's one thing. The other thing is the whole issue of endemic plants and plants growing specifically on specific soils. The serpentines have come to mind specifically. How, for instance, you can almost tell if there's serpentines versus ultramafic soils, derived soils, by just the color of the irises that are growing, whether they're blue or yellow. And I was just wondering if there was any specific endemic characteristics to any of the manzanita species that they only grow on some specific soil.
All right, let's try that on Tom Parker. Thanks for that, Charlie.
If you mean if there's some color difference or a specific leaf shape difference for a particular soil type, I'm not aware of anything like that.
Okay.
In the Bay Area, we have a lot of serpentine endemics in Marin County. There's one that's only found in Marin County on serpentine, and San Francisco has two serpentine endemics, the Presidio and the Franciscan manzanita. But they're all pretty similar looking, like a classic manzanita.
All right, and Michael Kaufman, to his question about using them for bird perches, which was an interesting sidetrack there, but sidelight. Is there a value for manzanita and madrone? Are they harvested?
Well, there's a couple answers there. Yes, they are harvested because I personally know that madrone wood is highly valued for its output for fires and your fireplace in the winter, mm-hmm. and manzanita as well. But it's, the problem is the wood just isn't that big. But it's definitely a decorative wood. A friend of mine got manzanita branches strung across her ceiling with lights through them, which I think is a very aesthetically pretty way to light a room and decorate a ceiling. So, but I've not heard about the bird perches. That's a pretty cool idea there. So,
all right, with the discussion of serpentine soil, I bring in a question from Carl and Selma asking if the Calmeopsis leachiana is related to manzanitas. Do you know that, Michael?
Well, it's in the same family. So Calmeopsis is in the heath family. But in that respect, it's not in the same subfamily as manzanita. But Tom, would you like to expand on that? Or
Hold on that a second, Tom.
We'll take
that after the break because we have to take one now. Field Guide to Manzanitas is the book we're talking about with Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker, co-authors with Michael Vasey. We'll come back to talk more with them and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the recently published Field Guide to Manzanitas, California, North America, and Mexico. All those great plants that inhabit our part of the world. You can impress your friends by letting them know it's the genus Arctostaphylos. The Field Guide is written by Michael Kaufman, Tom Parker, and Michael Vasey. Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker are our guests on the exchange, and you can join our discussion about manzanitas and madrones, part of the same subfamily called Arbutid. I'll let them handle it. 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about Calmeopsis leachiana, which, as Michael pointed out, is part of the heath family, so therefore part of the same general family as manzanitas. And we were asking Tom if he had a little further illumination on that.
Well, there's a lot of different subfamilies in the heath family, and Calmeopsis is pretty distant from madrone and Arctostaphylos manzanitas. The manzanitas and madrone seem to be in a fairly primitive part of the family, and actually the fungi that they have mutualists with are a good indication, because as you get further and further into more and more advanced groups of the heath family, they have different kinds of mycorrhizal structures. So Calmeopsis is in one of the more advanced lineages.
And I slaughtered that name. I was trying to read it on the fly. Arbutoidae?
Yeah, Arbutoidae.
And that is the subfamily that's manzanitas and madrones together?
That's right. It's just a modification of the genus Arbutus, the madrone genus. It's the convention that botanists use.
And so you got into this a bit before, Tom, but how do manzanitas make new manzanitas?
Well, that's a pretty fascinating question. When you're this far south in California as I am, the only way that they reproduce is from wildfire. The seeds have a dormancy that's only broken by chemicals that come from smoke. So you can actually play with manzanitas by going to your grocery store and buying liquid smoke and diluting it and adding it to the soil. But normally it takes a wildfire that burns through the vegetation, and that stimulates them. So they only have really one round of recruitment every time there's a wildfire.
Wow. Which is the genesis of the question from David in Happy Camp. He says, please talk more about natural fire and regeneration of plants in burned areas. Are manzanitas a pioneer species, and how do they come in after a fire, is his question.
Well, if they were there ahead of the fire, they never leave. Mm-hmm. The adults might be killed if they're the ones that we call obligate seeders, but they germinate the very next spring. They just are small at the beginning, and takes them a few years to get bolting because they're putting roots down, but then they regain their dominance in that vegetation pretty quickly thereafter.
Now, does the drought of the severity the region is currently experiencing present any hardship to manzanita?
Well, it presents a hardship to the adults, that's for sure, but it might facilitate some fire, and then that would stimulate recruitment of new individuals.
All right, so only by wildfire for some of the species, and for some of the others, is there another pathway?
I'm not really sure about Uva ursi because it grows way north in cold climates, and they do have wildfire up there, but I'm just not certain if it's restricted to only being after wildfire. I've seen it in New Jersey and on the coasts of Nova Scotia, and it seems to, at least in New Jersey, it's stimulated by fire, but I can't imagine that that's the case in sand dunes.
That's pretty amazing to think that actually it's the chemicals in smoke that that make the seeds do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of species that respond only to chemicals in smoke.
And so these are among the pioneers that will show up after a fire?
That's right. And in chaparral, there's a lot of annuals you see only after wildfire, and a large number of them respond to the smoke chemicals.
Hmm.
That's their cue to let them know that it's time to germinate.
So if there hasn't been a fire lately, you're not going to see some of those plants?
That's right. They just stay in the soil, dormant, waiting for that next fire.
Wow, that's some amazing stuff. We have some more calls here. Let's go to Bill in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking manzanitas with Tom Parker and Michael Kaufman.
Yeah, the amount of detail is really overwhelming and terrific. But my question was, how do the widely dispersed manzanitas get their transportation from one place to another?
All right. Michael, you want to take that one?
You know, I'm going to let Tom take that.
Okay.
I could do it, but he could do it better justice.
All right.
Let me translate Arctostaphylos uva ursi for you. That's Latin and Greek for bearberry. and large mammals like bears and coyotes, foxes, will eat the berries and distribute them, shall we say, later on. And that's their long-distance dispersal mechanism. They do have to get buried to be able to survive fire, and wherever the berries are deposited, rodents will find them and cache them in the soil and hope they remember to eat them later. So the main way they get dispersed is by large mammals for long distances, and small mammals do the job of burying them locally.
So when we talk about dispersal by bear, is it because the bears drop them or because the bears excrete them?
Yes, it passes all the way through, shall we say.
Okay. Arctostaphylos uber ursa?
That's right.
All right. Another call here from Chris in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tom Parker and Michael Kaufman.
Yeah, you guys were talking about uses of the manzanita, you know, and people using for burn perches. And I actually dig up burls of the green leaf and sell them. Actually, they're a shop, and it's a burl in Kirby has some of my burls. One burl was filled up the bottom portion of a Ford Ranger. I mean, they had to get a forklift to lift it out.
Wow.
But burls is a big thing on manzanita. They, for turning, for bowls, and for decorative, and all kinds of items. But I was just putting that in there that burls is one use for them.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the burl shop in Kirby. So how'd you, a forklift to get it out of the ground, was it still alive, or did you, was
no,
it?
No, I didn't get it. I had a sweat. I was working on it, thinking, well, it's not that big, and I kept going. It's like, man, this thing's gigantic. And I had a muscle in my truck, you know, perching on something and jam it in. They had to get a forklift to get it out. So they could get really big. I've got some where I had to roll it up a hill. I mean, they get big, and it's weird how they form. It's like when they layer. I don't know the term, but you get a branch on the ground, and that will start to burl, and they'll grow in the other one, and you just get big, gigantic ones.
Okay, so let's talk about the burls. I appreciate that, Chris. Very interesting details there. Tom Parker, what's going on with burls in manzanitas?
Burls are an excellent thing to bring up. They are the way that manzanitas resprout after fire. So burls are basically concentrated, very dense wood with lots and lots of dormant buds. And that's why they make such beautiful bowls and things like that. For the plant, it's a way of protecting dormant buds so that when the tops are killed by fire, they can resprout pretty quickly. But it's because it's so dense that makes that beautiful art, shall we say.
So are there seeds within the burl or under the burl? I mean, how does that work, the resprouting process?
Well, it's just the same adult. It's just that the tops are killed, and the dormant buds are released at that point, and they start growing. They have the same original root system, and they're protected from the fire by just being low to the ground and a little bit underground in some cases.
Now, there are a lot of tips in Field Guide to Manzanitas for one of the things, looking at the burls, apparently, Michael, to try to figure out what kind of manzanita you're looking at. Can you describe the process that you recommend to people when they're trying to figure out which manzanita they're dealing with?
Yeah, so when you're approaching manzanitas in the field, the first thing we recommend is to know where you are, which I think is pretty obvious because, like we said, they're so highly localized that you can really narrow down what you're going to see just by your location. But then about one-third of all manzanitas reproduce with that burl, and two-thirds reproduce via seed. So the burls are actually not always very easy to find because, as we mentioned, manzanitas drop their leaves. They're often on steep slopes, and things pile up over that burl. And so you kind of have to, if you're really into identifying it to the species or subspecies, you really have to dig around under the plant and look for that that bulge. It's often a bulge around the ground level or maybe just under the surface. And Tom, you recommend looking at it from below, right? If it's on a steep slope and you see that burl.
That's right. If you're looking from uphill down, then you tend to see all the litter that's accumulated. But if you're looking uphill, you tend to be able to see the burl more easily.
All right. More questions from listeners via email. Anne in Grants Pass asks, do some grow larger in different soils? I live on Mount Sexton with serpentine soil, and my manzanitas are about 3 feet tall at a max. The manzanitas and ashland are huge. Are they different species? That, again, from Anne in Grants Pass.
They're likely different species, but the same species will grow at different rates on different types of soils.
Given their propensity for growing in lousy soils, then what happens if they end up, if you plant them in pretty decent, well-ventilated and even perhaps well-watered soil, do they just not thrive? Do they get crowded out by other things, or do they die?
If it's well-watered and very fertile, they'll look okay at the beginning, and they tend not to do well through time, and they tend to die off on you.
Because of the overwatering, or because the fungi is not there with them, or a combination of things?
Yeah, sometimes it's like they begin to lose their ability to resist diseases. It really helps if they're stressed a little bit. They tend to make compounds in both their wood and in their leaves that resist pathogens at that point. Sometimes they're just so specially adapted that they just don't do well off their native soil type. For example, there was a plant that I put in my front yard that was only found on granite, and it just couldn't tolerate the conditions in my yard, which is horrible soil, but it's clay soil.
Does that mean that instead of the 9 manzanita species we mentioned at the top, you have 8 now?
Well, I try to have 10.
Okay, that's where things fell down.
I've got some friends in Medford, and they've decided to xeriscape their yard, so using drought tolerant plants, and they have a couple of species of manzanitas that are doing really well in the Rogue Valley, just in their front yard. But again, they're not watering a lot, and because of that, there's reduced competition from other species, like even grasses that might creep in and steal some space from the manzanitas.
Huh, interesting. So they've made a real niche for themselves. Johnny in Tequilma writes in about madrone and smoke. He says, I noticed that after the Longview fire in 87 in this area, you could pick out all the madrones in the hills by their blooms. Is that fairly typical post-fire behavior for any of the arbutus creatures, Tom?
Madrones resprout quite readily after fire, and they're pretty vigorous. I would imagine that they would be very easy to spot by blooming within a few years. I know that if you just drive most of the highways in Northern California toward Oregon, madrones are a huge part of the forest there, and when they come into flower, it's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm. All right. So are they generally going to be some of the first things that come back after any fire, or are there a few things that tend to precede them?
Again, nothing precedes them. Some things might be more prominent at the beginning because they might not be as fast as some other plants, but they're always there. They might just be top dead and just have to resprout is all.
Okay. Constance in Grants Pass writes in, great show. Does that mean I can't plant them in my yard? I've always loved and wanted them. So what do you guys recommend if somebody does want to have them nearby?
Just water them in very infrequently the first year and then stop doing it after that.
So really never water them again after that?
Pretty much.
Tom, can you give us a state of the manzanita? How are they generally doing across their range? And I guess this brings in the question of global warming and weather changes in climate are starting to affect where they're found.
I had a friend in Southern California tell me that a lot of the Big Berry manzanitas in the Santa Monica Mountains near Los Angeles are dying back, which was pretty surprising to me because that's one of the most drought-tolerant of the manzanitas. So it means that the adults are at least leaving, there's still seed in the soil. So if they have a fire, they might do okay, but it suggests that through time they're going to be moving north and we're going to start losing them in the south and at low elevations.
Given the vast range or the vast variety, we have 104 varieties listed in the book. I mean, can you have a favorite manzanita? Do either of you guys?
I have an affinity for the ones that live higher in the mountains at this point and are a little bit more widespread, things like Archistaphylos patula, which you can see across the higher mountains of Oregon. That's a favorite of mine.
All right. And you like a bunch of them, Tom, it sounds like.
I do. Some of the ones that I've named I really like. But actually the first one that I fell in love with also grows in Oregon, and that's what they call the hoary manzanita, the white hairy one, Archistaphylos canescens.
Right.
And it was one of the first ones that I learned.
Well, impress your friends by letting them know that you know the Arctostaphylos is the genus for the manzanita. Great great discussion with Michael Kaufman and Tom Parker. Their book is Field Guide to Manzanitas. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks for having us.